On Aspire with Emma Greed, I sit down with people who don't just dream big, they build big. From Mark Cuban to Mel Robbins, we talk about mindset, ambition, and the work that actually moves the needle. Listen to Aspire with me, Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast available now.
This is a true crime and real-time roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We dive into true crime stories reported out of Odyssey newsrooms across the nation. True crimes can captivate us, they can frighten us, and they can compel us into action. Sometimes these crimes can shape our lives in ways that we don't even realize. In this roundup, we'll be looking into some crimes from the past that have changed our world in sometimes surprising ways, and that are continuing to change it. Those include the Oxford school shooting in Michigan, the Appalachie school shooting in Georgia, and a deadly 1988 arson case in Missouri. A man who was arrested in connection with that arson nearly 30 years ago was just released from prison. And an Odyssey team that's been covering the case for years has some thoughts. But before we get into those cases, we have a few more true crime updates from newsrooms in Texas and New York. These crimes further complicate the already tense conversation here in the U.S. around immigration and war. One was a mass shooting event that occurred in Austin, Texas last weekend. That shooting claimed two lives and left 14 people injured. It happened just a day after President Donald Trump announced strikes on Iran. And the alleged shooter was found in pro-Iranian clothing, according to Odyssey station KRLD 1080 in Dallas. Here's the station reporting on the incident last Sunday, March 2nd.
A day after the attacks on Iran, a mass shooting in Austin is now being investigated as potentially an act of terrorism.
Gunfire erupted on West 6th Street around 2 a.m. Sunday morning. Austin Police Chief Lisa Davis said the suspect first fired a handgun from his SUV into the bar Buford's. He then exited the vehicle with a rifle.
Officers were coming toward him, and at the intersection, he was shot and he was killed.
FBI agent Alex Dorn.
It was potentially an act of terrorism.
The suspect identified as a 53-year-old naturalized American citizen born in Senegal. He was wearing a sweatshirt that said property of Allah and a shirt with the Iranian flag on it.
KRLD provided an update to this case the following day.
It's still too soon to come up with a motive for the shooting. That's according to FBI Special Agent Alex Duran.
It's always very difficult to determine what's in an individual's mind that leads them to commit this type of violence. So we will continue to, like I said, pour through the evidence.
And here's more from KRLD on the story.
Austin Police Chief Lisa Davis.
I believe one patient will be taken off life support sometime today, and then two other patients are still critical.
Davis adding that the guns used by the suspect were legally purchased. From the 24-hour news center, Chris Fox, News Radio 1080 KRLD.
I'm Austin York. Austin Police Chief Lisa Davis says there are plenty of questions that they will try to answer in the coming days, but now is the time for the community to begin to heal.
This has been difficult for our community, devastating to the impacted families, and challenging to our APD family.
She confirmed 19-year-old Ryder Harrington and 21-year-old Savitha Sean were killed in the shooting. Sean was a student at Texas while Harrington went to Texas Tech. This woman was among those who got caught up in the chaos.
We all ducked down. That's when everyone, like, kind of mayhem took place. And this is a lot of screaming, a lot of ducking and running and crawling over people.
Two remain in critical condition. Another will be taken off life support.
A third victim was later declared dead. Odyssey station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities identified that victim this week.
A Minnesota native was one of three killed in a mass shooting outside of a bar in Austin, Texas on Sunday. 30-year-old George Pedersen was raised in Glenwood, Minnesota, and had just moved to Texas in mid-February. Pedersen, a mixed martial arts fighter who was prepping for his first fight in May, died on Monday after he was taken off life support.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
In Buffalo, New York, the death of a Burmese immigrant has the community perplexed. Burma, a Southeast Asian nation officially known as Myanmar, has experienced a surge of conflict in recent years, resulting in refugees fleeing from the country, according to the United Nations. Many of those refugees have come to Buffalo. Among them was a 56-year-old man who was reportedly dropped off at a Tim Hortons in the city by Border Patrol agents last month and then found dead days later. Odyssey station WBEN in Buffalo interviewed immigration attorney Rosanna Berardi for insight into the situation.
We're trying to understand how a nearly blind Burmese refugee died on the street after being dropped off by Border Patrol agents at a closed Tim Hortons. Rosanna, from you, what is the protocol for the release of someone like Niral Amin Shah Alam?
Well, good morning. This one is certainly tragic. The protocol from the government is really to ensure that the person definitely has safety, has transportation support, housing, whether they need assistance with legal counsel, and if there's any type of risk or vulnerability that requires special accommodations. Now, this is internal guidance. It's not, you know, a federal rule or anything. And in this case, it seems like there was just a communication gap between several law enforcement agencies.
You know, I want to talk about that communication gap. The attorney representing Shah Alam's family was quoted in the Buffalo News talking about his arrest that took place a little over a year ago. This is the quote from the attorney. It wasn't his responsibility to understand the police. It was the responsibility of the police to understand that he doesn't speak English. He needs an interpreter. I read that. It stuck out to me. Is that ever advice that you would give to a client in how to act with police?
Well, I mean, look, there's tons and tons of people that don't speak English that are in the law enforcement system in Western New York and all over the U.S. for that matter. And there are a lot of interpreter services that the agencies use if they, you know, if they realize that somebody only speaks Spanish and there's no Spanish speakers, there's a phone number they can call and get an interpreter. So the government has these provisions. It's nothing new. They've been using them for a really long time. Why that didn't occur in this situation, I'm not really sure. And we just don't know a lot of the details on the internal processing of Mr. Alam.
You also used the word safe when you talked about protocols here. He was not wearing shoes, according to the mayor. Is that a major red flag here? He had those orange prison booties.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure what went on. It seemed like the DA's office wasn't even aware that he was being released. And he was somehow released, and Customs and Border Protection determined that he was here lawfully as a refugee. So he was not somebody that should be detained. So they did not bring him into the detention facility, but then they used their internal guidance to drop him off. And they may have asked him, you know, is this okay? He may have said yes, not knowing. I don't really know what exactly happened there, but it's winter time in Buffalo, and one would question why you would drop somebody off that, you know, wasn't properly dressed at a Tim Hortons. Maybe that Tim Hortons was close to his last address that was reported on law enforcement documents, but nonetheless, it just doesn't make sense to me.
The DA's office said that they did not know he was being released. They thought he was still going to be in custody until a sentencing that took place, that was set to take place in March. I mean, how often have you run into a scenario where the DA's office isn't made aware of a release of an individual, or there is such a disconnect in information that's out there?
Yeah, It's really difficult. We have so many people in very large government agencies that oftentimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. You know, for the most part, things work. Every once in a while, they don't. And unfortunately, this just seems like the perfect storm of miscommunication between the DA's office, CBP, the family, the attorney. It just seems like nobody knew what was actually happening. And unfortunately, we have a tragic result. And I'm not saying it's okay at all. I am saying there are a ton of people in these agencies and everyone's short-staffed. And it's just an incredibly challenging time.
What should come from a case like this?
Well, I see a lot of politicians demanding an investigation. CBP has made a statement, which is kind of unusual. They don't usually make statements on specific cases, but I think this is not the end of the story. I think we're going to find out exactly what happened. We know a little bit of the timeline, but I think there's going to be an internal investigation as to why he was dropped off without proper clothing or shoes at the Tim Hortons that was closed in the middle of winter in Buffalo. I think that part will really be unraveled. We don't know the cause of death at this point. So once those results come out, I think there's going to be a lot of issues here. I'm not sure what the family is going to do in terms of litigation, but this story is not over yet because we don't have all of the pieces to it.
WBEN also spoke to Stephen Sanyu of Burmese Community Services in Buffalo about the case.
I want to start with just a little background. Burmese Community Services, what exactly is the organization? What do you do?
We are the 501c3 nonprofit organization. We founded in 2013, all volunteer-based organization. We help people who the individual the business need, including, it's about not limit to, especially for the language barrier, culture adjustment, or service and resource. That's why we are sharing and helping them. And also we added us the brick between the community member and the American society because we have the language barrier and lack of knowledge and the resource.
Well, Stephen, the case of Shah Alam, when did this get on your radar? When it was reported missing, or did you know, were you following him before this?
First, I found that on the social media was the missing person. That's why we first noted that. Then later, two or three later, that the police found their body under this person. So that's why we aware, we know that.
There was some questions as to why he was in custody for so long. You know, many of these months he was being held on a $5,000 cash or bond. I mean, we understand he has a family, but is there any organization or are there any means from the community to be able to raise that money, a $5,000 bond to be able to get him out of prison for at least a little bit of time? Were you surprised to hear that he was in the holding center for so long on that amount?
Right. It's many things should be answered question and clear. Sorry. And clear answer the question for that. What is going on with them, including the legal issues, bond. So, you know, $5,000 amount of money, how do they get in? Where do they help the group of people assisted in those issues? And also, we don't know. We are not getting any information regarding this person saying the news come out. That's all we know. That's all we aware regarding Mr. Alam. So I'm not sure, and I don't want to be answer regarding the legal issue. So that's I'm sorry about that because I don't know detailed information. I don't want to be comfortable to answer for that.
Stephen, where do you think the biggest failure was with this case, with Mr. Alam?
That's a good question. So thank you for that. I believe that that's the language barrier gap communication gap between non-English speaker and, you know, the official, city official or the law enforcement or whatever. So that's a huge challenge for the language issue. So that's the number one issue. And also the people need to know their own right, and also the need to be find the resource where they can get the, you know, right information, right resource, and appropriate assistance for that. That's a very important for that too.
She loves it hot, he loves it cool. The Pod by 8 Sleep is a smart mattress cover that fits on your bed and keeps each side at the perfect temperature all night long. By staying comfortably warm or cool, the Pod helps you sleep deeper and wake up feeling more rested. Every morning, you get daily health insights and a sleep fitness score. Get up to $350 off with code DEEPSLEEP at 8sleep.com.
Hey guys, Fly on the Wall is back for another season. That's right, on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Now we'll move on to updates on some older cases, starting with the decades-old mystery of who left baby Jane Doe on the side of the road in Calverton, Long Island. Here's 1010 Winds in New York City with the report.
A handcuffed Denise Merker started shaking in court as prosecutors said back in 1993, the now 55-year-old hid her pregnancy. She did not want her baby girl, so she allegedly stuffed paper towels down her throat, killing the newborn. Merker's attorney, Danielle Koish, says her client pleaded not guilty.
There is a presumption of innocence, and I think it's really important that everybody remember that.
The DA's office says the cold case unit and genetic genealogy helped make the arrest. Merker is accused of tossing the baby on the side of the road in Calverton in a garbage bag.
And she's presumed innocent.
Parents are also the focus of the next two crimes we'll take a look at in this episode. After their son, Ethan, carried out the 2021 mass shooting at his school in Oxford, Michigan, killing 4 and injuring 7, Jennifer and James Crumbly became the first parents in the U.S. convicted for their child's mass shooting, due to their choice to allow 15-year-old Ethan access to a firearm. Their convictions set a new precedent that has sadly already become relevant in another case, the 2024 mass shooting by then 14-year-old Colt Gray at Appalachie High School in Georgia. Colt's father, Colin, has been convicted on second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter charges. Cooley Law School professor Tanya Krause-Phelan discussed the similarities and differences in the cases with WWJ News Radio's Taylor Dietz this week.
Let's start with the most obvious similarity, and that is both cases presented the first time, Crumbly's in Michigan and Mr. Gray in Georgia, that parents had been charged with a criminal offense, particularly a form of homicide, for a school shooting committed by their child. The other thing that's similar is both children, Ethan Crumbly and Colt Gray in Georgia, had been exhibiting signs of emotional and or mental distress. Now, there are some differences in the cases as to what the parents actually knew and how long they knew about it, which I think is reflected in the difference in the charges. And that's another thing that's different between the two cases. As you know, in the Crumbly case for the Oxford school shooting, the parents were charged with one of the least serious forms of homicide, right? Involuntary manslaughter. So that's drastically different than Colin Gray, who was charged with second degree murder, which is a more serious form of homicide. And it relates back to what the parents knew about the child's distress, when they knew it, and how much they knew about it.
Now, is there any other differences in these two cases? Obviously, all three of them were convicted, but any other differences that stand out to you?
Well, I think, you know, one of the procedural differences is that in the Georgia case, the Georgia legal system, criminal legal system, operates with a grand jury. And in Michigan, while we do have a grand jury statute, the predominant way individuals are charged with a crime in Michigan is by the prosecutor filing formal charges against the individual. And so to that extent, there was a decision made by a prosecutor in Michigan to charge, whereas in Georgia, a prosecutor thought charges should be filed and they took it to a grand jury. And the grand jury decided that, yes, there was probable cause to charge the individual. So that is one procedural difference. And I think there's a factual difference, too, that I also just mentioned a few minutes ago, is in the Crumbly case in Michigan, according to the facts that came out in trial and the evidence that was presented at both parents' separate trials, the morning of the shooting is when the parents were actually presented with the disturbing information that was on Ethan's schoolwork and some of the things he had written. Whereas in the Georgia case, the Gray case, the mother didn't have custody. The father had custody of Colt, and there had been some long-standing documented concerns about Colt's mental and emotional state. And I think that's why you saw a more serious homicide charge lodged against the father in the Gray case, because the knowledge he had about the child's condition and the stresses he was feeling and the sentiments he had exhibited were known for a longer period of time.
I know in the Oxford case, there's still to this day, there's a lot of talk about the school districts being at fault. And I was reading into this case as well. The defense actually tried to use the same technique, I guess, to blame the school. Do you think in that way the cases are similar, or does that still pose differences?
There are still differences, I think, because my understanding of the facts in the Gray case are that there had been other governmental agency involvement, or at the very least, investigations in the Gray case. So people were taking his mental health, his emotional health struggles seriously, whereas there's some indication in the Oxford case, not so much. So I'm not surprised that particular tactic did not work out well for the defense in the Gray case. Now, again, keep in mind, Colt still has to go to trial because he's the actual shooter, and yes, it's alleged at this point, but it'll be interesting to see if the defense in Colt's trial tries to point some responsibility in the direction of the school district.
And in regards to both of these cases being kind of the first, now, I did want to touch on the precedent. Obviously, Michigan and Georgia, very different gun laws, very different thoughts around gun violence prevention, things like that. Both still in both places, people either agree with parents being charged and convicted for the actions of their kids if they commit a mass shooting. Other people don't agree with it. But do you think that these cases are now setting a precedent, that this is now the precedent if your child commits an act of mass violence that depending on the circumstances, you will be charged and convicted?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I think all of the state jurisdictions in the United States right now are trying to figure out the precedential value of the Crumbly case and now of the Gray case. Certainly, there's no doubt that even though the statutes are very different, that the gun laws are very different in Michigan versus Georgia, you can bet that both the prosecution team and the defense team were studying and dissecting exactly how those prosecutions happened in Michigan. So that's very common in criminal prosecutions and defending people charged with crimes. As you look at how are other jurisdictions handling it? So to that extent, I think both of these cases present some precedential value. I wouldn't be surprised, and here's a prediction for you, I wouldn't be surprised that we start to see other states consider whether legislation needs to be passed to address these types of issues, whether we should be holding parents responsible for a mass shooting committed by their child. Now, I want to back up just a step on that, because in both of these cases, there was indications that the parents did have some awareness of the mental health struggles their children were having, and allowing, whether it be intentionally or negligently, the children with those struggles to have access to the gun was a big part of both of those cases. And I think for states who want to look at possible legislation going forward, that's going to be in their back of the mind. Were these two cases unique because of the children's struggles, or is this something that we need to consider writing a law for across the board? And I know that it's a divisive issue. Some people agree that, yes, the parents should be charged in situations like this, and others don't. But I think the underlying message, regardless of what side of the argument one finds themselves, is now that we have a much more accessible approach to gun ownership in the country, with those rights come responsibilities. And as a responsible gun owner, and that's what I hear from people that I talk to, they're like, you have to be a responsible gun owner, and that means you don't allow children to have access to those unsupervised, depending on their age. So I think it's going to be fascinating to watch what other states do. Do they proactively create some laws in case this type of event happens in their state? Or are the states going to wait, unfortunately, until something drastic happens and then use the Crumbly case or the Gray case as their blueprint for how they prosecute the case?
Just as the Crumbly case continues to have reverberations into the present day, a 1988 arson incident that claimed the lives of six firefighters in Kansas City still haunts the region. Recently, one of the people who was eventually convicted of the crime was released from prison. This week, the Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City unpacked the complicated, maze-like history of this case and its national impact on firefighting.
I was pleased to see this over the weekend. Don't be angry. If you really, really looked into the details of this case, you would be pleased too. One of the men convicted in the 1988 Kansas City firefighter deaths has been released from prison. We are not taking away from that historic day in this town or how devastating that tragedy was for so many. Mm-hmm. However, I continue to believe passionately they did not get this one right with respect to the prosecution of all of those kids years ago. A federal judge has ordered the release of Richard A. Brown this week, vacating the life sentence he received nearly three decades ago for his role in the 1988 arson that led to the deaths of six Kansas City firefighters. The order was handed down Friday in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Missouri. It granted Brown's amended motion for compassionate release. It credited him for the nearly 29 years he was incarcerated. Part of the reason that the judge agreed that he gets to go home is that he was 18 at the time. Mm-hmm. And knowing everything that we know now, whether you believe this group did the crime or not, I don't know that in today's day and age for a crime like that at age 18, you would get much beyond 30 years.
So I remember covering this trial in federal court downtown in the late 1990s. And something rubbed me the wrong way. And I was just a young buck reporter, so, you know, what do I know? But there was just something about it that I'm like,
Listen to this from the Kansas City Star, and then I want you to remind everybody your recollection of this. Mm-hmm. Over the years, the case has been criticized by the fallen firefighters' families, prosecutors, and the defendants convicted alongside Brown, who have always maintained their innocence. None of them have ever gone back to say, all right, I did it, let me out. They probably could have gotten out earlier if they had said, I did it. They have always said, it was not me. And calls for accountability came after the Department of Justice report said, there was credible evidence that two other people were involved.
It's my recollection, and you know, this is a 30-year memory, so forgive me, that all or most of them were tried at the same time.
I believe that is correct.
And I remember as a young reporter here at KMBZ, I was sent down to cover this entire trial at the old federal courthouse downtown, and which I think is now a post office, if I'm not mistaken, but whatever. And there was a little walkway that would go to an underground parking garage at the old courthouse. And after they had been convicted and sentenced, they were brought up from the underground parking garage up this long concrete ramp, you know. And all of us reporters were dangling our microphones over the side to see if any of them would say anything. And I don't know who it was. I don't recall.
It was one of the males.
It was. There was only one woman involved, if I remember correctly. But one of the men screamed out, "They've got the wrong people. We didn't do this."
Do you not remember, Scott, that prosecutors offered some or all of them immunity to flip and just tell us what happened?
Yeah, on each other.
Not a single one of them took the opportunity. And you know, prosecutors said, "You're facing life in prison.
Yeah.
Why don't you just flip and tell us what happened?" None of them agreed to do that. They said, "We didn't do it then." They said, "We didn't do it now."
Yeah.
One of them died in prison, and I think one or two still remain behind bars.
That is correct.
One of them has been released, called into our program a couple years ago when he was released.
I remember. And I would love to talk to Richard Brown if at some point he's willing to do an interview. Now that I'm looking at pictures of Richard Brown, I want to say, I can't say this definitively, I want to say it was him who screamed up from that walkway, "They've got the wrong people. We didn't do this."
Brian Shepard was released from prison in 2017. He's the one who called into our program after he was incarcerated 22 years. Skip Shepard died in prison in 2009. Darlene Edwards and Frank Shepard remain incarcerated.
You know, and saying all of this, and I want to be very clear for both of us, we're not taking anything away from the absolutely tragic deaths of those six Kansas City, Missouri firefighters. And may God bless them always and their families. It was just, and this was in 1988, if I remember correctly. These people didn't go on trial till 1997. And, you know, just to repeat myself for just a moment, the entire time I was watching this trial, I'm like, where's the evidence? Where is it? And I sat through every second of that trial downtown and wondered every single day, where is it? Where are the fingerprints? Where's the
nothing?
The
stuff, they had nothing.
I know.
In the Justice Department report that was finalized in 2011, but never publicly disclosed in its entirety until, when was that Star investigation?
I think it was in 2016.
2022, I think, when they read this.
Oh.
Records released back then by the Justice Department through a court order show investigators found new information 10 years prior to that to suggest the two security guards may have been involved.
And where are they now?
I don't know if they are still alive or not, Scott. One of the best investigations was a late Kansas City Star investigation into this, and I'm trying to find that investigation. It wasn't Mike Hendricks, but it was somebody that poured years into this and then wrote about it and made the very compelling case that not only did these they were not the sharpest knives in the drawer, back then.
Let's call it what it is. They were yahoos.
They were yahoos.
Yeah.
And part of the argument was, do you really think that these five ding-a-lings who never would take the bait and turn on each other to say what happened, despite the fact they were all facing life in prison, do you really think they pulled this off?
And not only pulled it off, but got away with it
for
9 years.
Were they the easy targets in an investigation that needed to be wrapped quickly because it devastated this town?
Now, let's go back to this story. On the release of Richard Brown, the story says compassionate release. Normally that means that somebody has a terminal illness.
Compassionate because he was 18 at the time and he's already served 30 years. This does not mean he's exonerated. This is still on his record. He'll go on probation. It was Mike McGraw, the late Kansas City Star investigative reporter Mike McGraw.
That's right.
Who did an incredible series of stories beginning in 2007 examining that case. And so many witnesses years later, Scott, said they were pressured to implicate the defendants. Years later. Because you know this, the city was under pressure to get the damn thing solved.
Well, it, keep in mind, and again, repeating myself, it had been 9 years since the explosion in South Kansas City until the arrest of these five, many of them related to one another. And again, I think all five went on trial at the same time, if I'm not mistaken.
It was a 4-year court battle just to have the documents released from the Department of Justice. And by the way, hats off, it was Shook, Hardy, and Bacon that represented the other defendant who said, no, we are going to fight to have these records released. When the records were released, lo and behold, the investigation showed we think it might be the other two.
So why not then with the other two, Darlene Edwards and I think it's Brian Shepard who remains in prison still, why are they not, and maybe they are, appealing all of this? Two have now been released. One died in prison.
Yeah.
And two remain in prison. Why are they not fighting tooth and nail, saying, look at these documents? You know, investigators were under the impression that it might have been two security guards.
A friend of one of the security guards signed an affidavit that was included in the Star's reporting that said he had come to one of the security guards' apartments on the morning of the explosions. She appeared upset and nervous and allegedly said, quote, I've been involved in something bad and we didn't mean for anyone to get killed. Now, did they set out, if in fact it was those security guards, did they set out to murder the firefighters? You have to remember, this started with a truck arson.
Mm-hmm.
And the truck arson then spilled over to the hazmat site that was never properly marked.
Right.
Firefighters move in to put out the fire, and the trailers that held the...
Didn't know the hell they were walking into.
Exploded. And from there, we have our current day hazmat triangular warning signs.
Is that a fact?
That is a fact. That was born out of the Kansas City case.
I did not know that.
Where construction sites, semis now all have those dark red, dark blue.
Yeah.
What is that shape? Diamond-shaped placards that tell you there's
ammonium
nitrate here.
It's true, according to the Kansas City Star. The placement of placards indicating the presence of hazardous materials inside buildings and vehicles did become standard after this incident. That's just one of the ways that true crimes impact our lives every day without us even thinking about it. Thank you all so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KRLD 1080 in Dallas, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, WBEN News Talk in Buffalo, 1010 Winds in New York City, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, and the Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City. You can find these shows and stations on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can also get these true crime updates every week by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.